All over the news these days is the war between the modern nation of Israel and the country of Iran. And Iran has historically been known as Persia. And the history of the biblical book of Esther goes back about 2,500 years and gives us some insight into the relationship between the tribe of Judah and the nation of Persia. And particularly, we're going to look then at the ancient Persia and its relationship with the Jews, and we can project ahead then to modern Persia and its relationship with the Jews. I'm going to go back a few years to when I was a college student. I was young once, we'll stipulate for the record, and I was driving on my car to the annual Holy Day church service the Bible refers to as the Day of Atonement. And we can read about the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 23 and many other places in the Bible. Well, I'm in my car and I'm listening to the radio. Well, in Israel, the Day of Atonement in the Hebrew language is called Yom Kippur. And it is a fast day. That doesn't mean it goes really quick. A fast day means doing without food or water for a 24-hour period from sunset of one day to sunset of the next day. Well, everybody who keeps this annual biblical holy day, Day of Atonement or Yom Kippur, is going to be hungry and thirsty during that 24-hour period of time. Well, I'm driving along on the highway on my way to the church service, and a news flash came on the radio. It announced that there were war had broken out in the Middle East. The year was 1973. The country of Israel was attacked by several of its Arab neighbors, led by Egypt and Syria. And the Arab attackers chose the day of Yom Kippur because they knew that Israeli Jews would be fasting. They would be doing without water or food for that 24-hour period. And the theory was that the Israeli army would be less able to defend itself because they would be physically and mentally weaker without the food and water. Well, Egypt, in the preparation for this 1973 Yom Kippur War, as it became to be called, they had positioned 100,000 troops ready to cross the Suez Canal into the Sinai Peninsula. But the Israelis put up a vigorous defense to the Egyptian invasion. In this war, many thousands of people died, a lot of military equipment was destroyed. But at the same time as the Egyptians attacked Israel from the south, the Syrians attacked Israel from the north. Two different directions Israel had to defend itself. The Yom Kippur War officially lasted from October 6th to October 25th of 1973. But the fighting didn't actually stop until October 28th. And then there were continued skirmishes all the way till January 18th of 1974. This was the fall of 1973 that this war broke out. My brother, who many of you have met, was also a college student at that time. He was working on an archaeological project in Israel, in Jerusalem, and during that previous summer. So he had only been home for 2 months and back to college in Pasadena before the war started. At that time, OPEC, many of you who have a little gray hair know the word OPEC, Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, led by Saudi Arabia, they declared an oil embargo against the United States for supporting Israel in the Yom Kippur War. Gasoline prices increased in the United States. Gas rationing was instituted by then President Nixon. And if you recall, if your car license plate was an odd number, you could put gas in your car on an odd-numbered day. If your license plate was an even number, you could put gas in your car on an even-numbered day. And the decorator plates, as I recall, went on even-numbered days. But before the war, I was buying gas for 22-point-something cents per gallon. And the price of gas rose sharply when a war broke out. Surprise, surprise, the world's oil supply was disrupted. And within the next several years, and by 1979, it was hard to find gas for less than a dollar a gallon. The nation of Israel in 1973 at the war, Arab-Israeli war called the Yom Kippur War, they fought vigorously, and it ended with the survival of the modern country of Israel. But 1973 was not the first modern war fought by Israel for its survival. Following World War II, the United Nations formed the new nation of Israel as a homeland for the Jews after the Jewish slaughter during World War II. And as soon as that nation was formed, a war broke out against Israel's Arab neighbors, and they tried to exterminate this new country, modern nation of Israel. And Israel calls this war of survival its war of independence. This little postage stamp-sized country in the Middle East survived. But that wasn't in 1948. That was 1948. But that wasn't the only war fought. It was 48 and 73. When I was in high school in 1967, Israel was again attacked by its neighbors, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan, in another attempt to wipe Israel off the map. And the war lasted from June 5th to June 10th, inclusive, and it's now referred to, this 1967 war, as the Six-Day War. And again, the Jewish nation survived. Well, today we're very aware of the modern direct conflict between Israel and the modern country of Iran. But prior to 1935, the country of Iran was known as Persia. Indeed, today, the people who come from Iran, they're natives, they speak Persian. They don't call it Iranian, because for thousands of years, it's been Persian. Now, we do read about Persia in the Bible, and we read about Persian kings, Cyrus, Darius, Artaxerxes, and so forth. In the Bible, we also read about the capture of the nation of Judah. Now, this is following King Solomon. Israel was composed of 12 tribes, and it divided. 10 of the tribes went north with Jeroboam. 2 of the tribes, Judah and Benjamin, stayed in the southern kingdom, and the others went to the northern kingdom. And the northern kingdom was overwhelmed and conquered and carried away by Assyria, eventually, somewhere around 612 BC. The southern kingdom was conquered by the Babylonian Empire in 539 BC. And it was earlier than that, but the Babylonian Empire in turn was conquered by the Persians. You get the idea? There's been a lot of warfare going on around the world for a long time. People not getting along and seeing things very different. About 486 BC, a new Persian king came to power. And the Jews had been carried away from Jerusalem and the southern kingdom of Judah, which included the tribe of Benjamin, had been carried off to what was then Babylon, now controlled by Persia. And a king called Ahasuerus came to power. So we are now looking at a period of time when Islam was not yet even established. There was no such religion as Islam in Persia or in the Middle East. That didn't come about until over 1,000 years later, in the early 600s AD, in the 7th century. But at the time of this, we're looking back in 486 under this Persian king Ahasuerus. The Jews were living far from home, and that includes the tribe of Benjamin, which were included together. And so when we read the book of Esther, and you'll want to pull that book open to that book today, we read about the Persian king Ahasuerus, because Persia was a large empire from India to Egypt. That covers a big chunk of the world, India to Egypt. And in the book of Esther, and I'm not going to quote every verse, I'll do a spot from time to time. In fact, in the chapter 1, we read about the queen of Persia was deposed, removed from her queenship for refusing to obey the king. In chapter 2, the king set up a search for a replacement queen. And so, of course, what would this emperor do? He had his pick of whoever was from India to Egypt and everybody in between. And of course, it wouldn't be right unless he picked the most beautiful unmarried woman that he could find in his empire. So he sent out people to search, and a young Hebrew gal named Hadassah, and in Persian, her name was Esther. She was one of the number of young ladies that were considered. So what did they do for these young ladies? They put them in isolation for 1 year, and all of their needs were taken care of. Now, this young lady named Hadassah, in Persian is called Esther, her parents had died when she was young. And this Esther was raised by her cousin Mordecai. Now, we think of cousins usually about the same age. Clearly, they were not about the same age. And I give the example of my wife and I have a grandson who's 26 years old. Well, he'll be 27 in September. Last August, we had our youngest grandchild. They're about 26 years apart. So we could see the spread. Now, their mothers are 17 years apart. So we could see how that the oldest child of one and the youngest child, oldest child of the oldest and the youngest child of the youngest, how there could be such an age spread, and how that was a responsibility then when the parents, Esther's parents died. Somebody had to raise this little girl. So we can see how that age gap can happen, where you have now a foster father and a foster daughter, albeit they were cousins. Now, the young ladies preparing to be a future queen were held in isolation for 1 year to see which one would be the new queen of Persia. And Esther was given 7 personal servants to see to her every need. Wouldn't that be nice? You have 7 personal servants, day or night, snap your fingers, whatever you needed or wanted was right there. They were ramping up to see who was going to be the queen. Now, what they don't put in the text, but I've read elsewhere, is why would the king keep somebody in isolation for a year? Well, one reason is to make sure they weren't pregnant by somebody else. And that they don't say that here, but that was the custom, is that there was an isolation kept because the king's line had to be pure, so they were under guard, isolated for that period of time. However, this young lady, whom they called Esther, was instructed by her foster father, her cousin Mordecai, to not mention her ethnic background as a Hebrew. Don't rock the boat. Don't say anything. And so when we read the book of Esther, we can discover, and we'll turn to Esther 2:20, we realize that Mordecai had a great working relationship with his adoptive daughter. And it is apparent there is great respect and honor between the two. So in Esther 2, in verse 20, Esther did the commandment of Mordecai like as when she was brought up with him. So she listened to her foster or adoptive father. Now, in the book of Esther, in chapter 2, we read in verses 19 and 21 about Mordecai, Esther's older cousin. He had some kind of responsible job in the palace of the Persian king. Mordecai was sitting in the gate, which is a way of saying he was a decision maker of some kind. If we read in the Beyond Today Bible commentary, we read this. Mordecai remains constantly concerned over Esther's welfare, and she continues to follow his instructions and may have given him an official position. The expositor's notes on verses 19 and 20 read, Mordecai's position at the gate was not that of an idler, but represented some kind of duty or official position he occupied. Nowadays, I guess you can think of somebody sitting in the gate. You think of a beggar on the street corner or somebody when they're passing by, got their hat out, hoping for something. But in this case, the expositor's notes note, he may have been appointed to this position by Esther to give him easier access to the royal quarters. So he would have access as a as a dignitary, a decision maker. Now, the men who sat at the gate were frequently elders or leading respected citizens, and they settled disputes that were brought before them. And I have a whole raft of verses. I'm not going to read them all, but I'll give you a couple of examples of people who sat in the gates, because what happens in the gate? An examination of certain verses. They don't say a Christian shouldn't sit in the gate, be a decision maker, because decisions and judgments had to be made. If we take a look, and I'll just throw a few of these verses in the book of Ruth, chapter 4 and verses 1 and 2, and if we know the story of Boaz and Ruth, Boaz wanted Ruth for a wife, but somebody else had a previous right to Ruth as a wife. So in Ruth 4, and starting in verse 1, Boaz went to the gate and sat there, and behold, a close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. And Boaz said, "Come aside, friend, sit here." And when he sat aside and sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here," and they sat down. And we go through this now in verses 9 through 11. And Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You're witnesses this day that I brought all that was Elimelech's and that was, and then of his son Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance." He was entitled to marry the widow because of his relationship. And it goes on, if we read on this, "You are witnesses this day." And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses." Think of this as a notary, a statement that was notarized. It was a public statement here that this was an official transaction. The person who said, "I'm not going to marry Ruth," freely assented in public to letting Boaz marry Ruth. We have another example of in 2 Samuel 15, 2, about it being in the gates. And this is when Absalom was trying to usurp the kingdom away. Absalom, the son of David, was trying to usurp the kingdom away from King David. In 2 Samuel 15, starting in verse 2, "Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was, whoever, anyone had a lawsuit to come to the king for a decision, Absalom would call out and say, 'What city are you from?' And he would say, 'Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel.'" Absalom was trying to head off the decision-making to the king by putting himself in the gate or on the way so that he would make the decision and they would respect his decision. Well, later in Samuel, 2 Samuel 19:8, "The king rose and sat in the gate, and they told all the people, saying, 'There is the king sitting in the gate.' And the people came before the king." The gate was where people, where decisions were made. And we can read multiple examples of that. If you read In the Gate, you can look it up through the Bible. There are many, many examples. Job sat as a judge. We can read Job 29:7. Proverbs 22:22, "Do not rob the poor because he's poor, nor oppress the afflicted at the gate." It's just because somebody comes and asks for justice, they want justice. And indeed, Lamentations chapter 5, verse 14, "The elders have ceased gathering at the gate, and the young men from music." In other words, things as business stopped as usual. That's why it's called the Book of Lamentations. There's a lot of crying going on. And if we read Amos 5:15, very short verse, "Hate evil, love good, establish justice in the gate." So in the gate was a place where decisions were made. You might think of it as a court, and things were established. So Mordecai was sitting in the gate of a Persian king. What an unusual thing to have done. But he was sitting in the gate of King Ahasuerus. And Mordecai discovered that there was a plot to kill the Persian king. And Mordecai became aware of this plot, and he reported it to the king, and the conspirators were caught and hanged. An official record was made of Mordecai revealing the plot to kill the king. Intriguing, rather, because he's trying to save the king that has his people kept captive. And yet, Esther is, of course, his stepdaughter and cousin, who may very well have gotten him that position. And he was doing out of respect because of what happens if the king was killed. That would affect the king's widow as well. In chapter 3 of the book of Esther, the king appointed a man named Haman to become the chief administrator of the Persian Empire. Now, let's think about this. The Persian Empire is from India to Egypt, this huge landmass area, and he appoints a chief administrator. Can one person make all the decisions? King can't do it. He's got to delegate responsibilities. So he has basically an assistant king, as it were, an administrator named Haman. In chapter 3, in verse 2, we read that Mordecai would not bow or pay homage to Haman. This was a public lack of respect that was very displeasing to Haman. Can you imagine the ego that Haman would have? He's now the big shot under the king for this huge empire, and there's this Hebrew guy that will not bow or respect him. And he's one of those who could make command things in the name of the king, and they would carry it out. Well, Haman had discovered that Mordecai was a Hebrew, but that would be too awkward to kill him directly. So Haman figured out if he couldn't find a way to kill Mordecai directly, he would get rid of Mordecai by getting rid of all the Hebrew people. If we read then Esther 3:1, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were with the king's gate and paid homage to Haman, for the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. And you know, you have a lot of people think, well, aren't we just supposed to mindlessly bow or pay homage to anybody who's in authority? But if we read the Bible, Beyond Today Bible Commentary, it exposes a little more information, because Esther 3:1 tells us that Haman was an Agagite. Many others see an Agagite, according to the Beyond Today Bible Commentary, as a descendant of King Agag of the Amalekites in the days of Saul. We can refer back to 1 Samuel 1:15. Josephus refers to Haman as being by birth an Amalekite. He's written in the Antiquities of the Jews, and Jewish tradition continues that writing. The Amalekites were a bunch of Edomites. Now, Isaac had two sons, twins. One was Esau, and the other was Isaac. I mean, we'll get it right. But the children of Esau were called children of Edom, or Edomites. So the Amalekites were descendants from Edom, from Esau. And if we read in Exodus 17:8, they became the enemies of the Israelites. And God had ordered Saul to wipe them out. But King Saul didn't comply. He spared Agag, and the prophet Samuel then later put Agag to death. Now the name Agag seemingly denotes prime ruler. It could have been a title borne by the Amalekite kings. But as explained in the Beyond Today Bible Commentary, it's likely that the Edomites ranged over a wide area in the Middle East. And some of the Amalekites would have settled in Central Asia and could have been then in the Persian province of Agag that was made up of Amalekites. Well, Haman wanted to desire to exterminate the Jewish peoples in verses 5 and 6. And that can be explained because he was of Amalekite heritage. The Bible plainly says he was an Amalekite. And it says, indeed, the animosity over and envy over Israel's blessings goes way back between Jacob and Esau, from whom the Edomites and Amalekites had descended. In the Middle East, it's still true today. Old antagonisms die hard. And we're looking at over 2,500 years ago. Why did Mordecai refuse to bow? Was it because he believed a person shouldn't bow to another human being? Doesn't seem so, because that was just an accepted cultural expectation of the day. But Mordecai's refusal to bow or pay homage to Haman was really more of the kind of character or person that Haman was. Haman was really a despicable person, and the evidence of that is he wanted to exterminate all the Jews. And it's likely that Haman saw the signs, Mordecai saw these signs with Haman, and he understood Haman to be an enemy. In Psalm 15, in verse 4, the one who abides in God's tabernacle, the one who will dwell on the holy hill in God's kingdom, is one in whose eyes a vile person is disguised or despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. Did Haman honor the Lord? No. Did he make his evil known, a vile person? He didn't fear God. So a person of God doesn't show respect to someone of bad character regarding their wealth, position, or rank in life. And this phrase refers to someone who estimates character as it is in itself and not derived from a rank or relationship or station. So some people want to give honor to every evil person if they have a certain rank. But Mordecai didn't. He refused to bow or do homage to the high-ranking Haman. And in the end, we will read that Mordecai, Esther, and all the Jews were all blessed. Well, you can say that Mordecai didn't refuse or did not bow to Haman just because Haman was evil, but only because one must not bow to another human being. But the Bible doesn't say that. The act of bowing was not the issue. The issue was one of character. We can... In Esther 3:5, when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, Haman was full of wrath. So Haman was very angry that Mordecai would not show respect to him. But this same word, H in Strong's H7812, the same word means to reverence as it used to use the word bow. In Genesis 23:7, Abraham stood up and bowed. Same word. Himself to the people of the land, even the children of Heth. Genesis 29:12, again, Abraham bowed himself before the people. We can read many examples. You just link the word bow or bowed, you can see that there wasn't a biblical admonition not to bow, generally speaking, or show obeisance, but rather it had to do with the character of the person that you were honoring. And I'm not going to go through, there's just a couple dozen verses here. We'd be here a while if I went through all the bowed verses. David bowed to Jonathan, Ruth bowed to Boaz, Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance to him, same word. And so we have these numerous examples for this. If we take a look, then it's Haman's identity as an Amalekite would explain Mordecai's refusal as a Jew to bow to Haman. Now, it wasn't wrong to bow to human leaders, as we've mentioned earlier. But the most probable reason, in the Expositor's Bible Commentary says, Mordecai's pride was no self-respecting Benjamite would bow before a descendant of the ancient Amalekite enemy of the Jews. Well, Haman was very upset. So he tricked the Persian king Ahasuerus into issuing a decree that on a certain day, all Jews of every age could be killed and their possessions seized. Because if he couldn't do one, he was going to do them all, and that one would be subserved into the rest. And the king, and he said, there's a foreign people among you, and they could rise up and make real problems for you. So the king said, go ahead and sign it. Here's my seal, and do that. And so Ahasuerus issued a decree on a certain day then that Jews could be killed and their possessions seized. Now, what was Haman interested in? Killing Mordecai and seizing all the Jewish possessions. Well, that was a bonus. He even offered the king that he could pay him if he would let him do this. It's called a return on investment. He'd put a small amount down and collect everything that the Jews had. Well, then we read in Esther 4 about Mordecai asking Esther to intercede with the king Ahasuerus on behalf of the Jews. But she was fearful because she said if she went before the king without being invited, she could suffer the death penalty. And the way they have, the protocol was, if you went before the king without being invited, if he held out his scepter, the royal scepter, you would be accepted. If he didn't, they would haul you off and kill you. The king only allowed people in his presence whom he invited or allowed. So Esther had a valid concern, you know, I want to preserve my neck here. And in Esther 4:13, Mordecai issues a commandment, the statement that's still quoted today to motivate people to do the right thing. In Esther 4:13, and Mordecai told them to answer Esther, another, he had an intermediary, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews, for if you remain silent at this time, completely silent this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Wow. In other words, was that the reason that she was selected to become a queen in order to be able to save the Hebrew peoples in the Persian Empire? Well, we read in Esther 4:16 that Esther, even though she has the high title of queen, she still listens to and honors the cousin that raised her up as an adoptive father. And in Esther 4:16, what was Esther's decision? The young lady said, go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. How many of us have fasted for more than 1 day? How many more than 2 days? How about 3 full days, no food or water? How long can you make it without water before you tip over? They say about 3 days. And then you'll be dehydrated to the point that you won't make it. But so she was going to, so serious that she was going right to the limit to fast and then go into the king. And if it works, it works. If it doesn't, she put her life on the line. So not only does Esther do the commandment of Mordecai, but then Mordecai listens and cooperates with Esther because the two, the adoptive daughter, father and daughter, have that close working relationship. And together they're able to defeat, as we read on through the book of Esther, and save the Jews. And it's interesting, the God is never mentioned in the book of Esther, but it's apparent the two have God's blessing and help. In Esther 4:17, in Esther 4:17, so Mordecai went his way and did all according to all that Esther had commanded him. So they had that working relationship. Basically, what we're learning here is that unless you act, you will not escape the evil. It requires some action. So that Esther verses 13 and 14, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this, has become a very well-known phrase in Hebrew history. because it requires action, not just sitting there twiddling your thumbs or sitting on your hands and hoping that you will be saved somewhere. And the Beyond Today commentary, it says there's no question as to why the Jews still existed as a people. They have been delivered time and time again by the God of their forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And over the centuries, God had made many promises that could not be fulfilled if all the tribes of Israel were wiped out. So those who had faith in the plan of God and how he was using the nation of Israel understood, including Mordecai, they knew that God would save his people somehow. It was just a matter of how. Well, the statement of that Esther refusing to act would lead to her and her father's perishing was probably a warning of divine judgment, reminiscent of Christ's later remark concerning the end time in Luke 17:35. Whoever seeks his save his life will lose it. So if Esther said, no, I just want to stay alive here, I'm not going to do that, what would have happened? She would have lost it with all the other Jews that were killed. And yet she took action. There's a remarkable statement at the end of Esther 4:14 when we say, who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So it's not just a coincidence that this young Jewish woman, Hadassah, became the queen of the Persian Empire at that very time in history. It's hard to argue that it was anything but the work of God. Now, an all-powerful God didn't have to have Esther. Wasn't a requirement, didn't have to have her. He could have saved the people of Israel, of Judah and Benjamin, in another way. But she had been placed in that position to be used if she were willing. In McLaren's exposition, Mordecai's words carry a large truth applicable to us all. The source of endowments, possession, and capacities is God. He's the source. His purpose in them all goes far beyond the happiness of the receiver. Dignities and gifts of every sort are for our use in carrying out his great design or good to our fellows. In other words, we're given position or possibility or the potential to do something, then we actually have to do it. Esther was made the queen, not that she just would live in luxury or be the plaything of the king, but that she might serve the greater Israel. Her power became a duty. Responsibility then is measured by capacity. Her obligation has advantages. Gifts become burdens. All men are stewards, and God gives his servants their talents, not for selfish squandering or hoarding, but to trade with, to pay the profits to God. Penetrating insight into the source and intention of all, which we have carried a solemn lesson for everyone. This argument holds in reference to many forms of conflict with national and social evils, meaning stand up and say something or do something. If Christian people allowed vice and godlessness to go unchecked, they will not escape the contagion in some form or another. How many of good men's sons have been swept away by the immoralities of great cities? How few families are there there is just not one dead? In other words, multiple. How is the godliness of the church cooled down by the low temperature around us? We have to be careful of that. Or another way of saying it is, it's the water we swim in. Don't let it pollute our lives, because that's the world around us. The low temperature around us cannot reduce our fever for God. There's an interesting blurb in here in the book of Esther, and we can turn to chapter 6. King Ahasuerus couldn't sleep. Any of you have a sleepless night? What do you do? Well, if it's real sleepless night, I get up and get some work done. Well, if I, for whatever reason, I wake up after 2 or 3 hours, out comes the computer, get down, and I get some work done. Or I'll go to the kitchen and prepare what I need to for that day, get something done, and then go back to bed. Well, what did the King Ahasuerus do? He called in. Remember, he had plenty of servants. Woke them up, called them in, unless they were all awake on duty, and said, "Read to me the book of the history of the kings." And it revealed in that book of the book that Mordecai had saved the king's life. And he realized in Esther 6 that he hadn't really honored the person who saved his life. And of course, that person was Mordecai. So, what did King Ahasuerus do? He called in his number one administrator. In Esther 6:6, he called in Haman. And Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" Who did the king already pick to be his chief administrator from India to Egypt and throughout the Middle East? And verse 7, Esther 6:7, and Haman answered the king. Now, mind you, he's got his own self-interest at heart. "For whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, and which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand by one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to his honor. Then parade him, the honored person, on horseback throughout the city square and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man who the king delights to honor.'" So we can see what Haman wants to do. He sets it up so he can be the one that's honored and says, "Have some well-known dignitary lead the horse around for the guy that's on the horse and loudly proclaim the honor." And what does the king say in Esther 6 in verse 10? "The king then said to Haman," you know, the definition of humor is a sudden condescension to the unexpected. Now, I don't think Haman found this verse very humorous, but there was definitely some sudden condescension to the unexpected. "King said to Haman, 'Hurry, take the robe and the horse, as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate.'" That's bad enough. And then he followed it by saying, "Leave nothing undone, all of which you have spoken." Well, so he has to take the person he despises the most on the face of the earth, put him on the king's horse, dress him in the king's robe. The horse has to have the king's insignia on the horse's headgear, the crest, and march him around and shout to the world, "This is what will be done to someone that the king honors." Talk about awkward embarrassment. That's probably one of the nastiest cases that I can read about in the Bible. Okay. Ultimately, when we read through the book of Esther, the king cannot revert to, he cannot undo a law. Once the law is issued, he can't undo it. That's the law of the Medes and Persians. So what does he do? He issues a new law. And it said, "Well, if you want to kill the Jews, they're fully capable of defending themselves, so you're at risk if you do it, and I'm not going to help you." Ooh. Ooh. So, what happens? Doesn't look good to overrun all of the Jews. They can fully defend themselves. And once again, the Jews in Persia were saved. Now, I want to fast forward this 2,500 years. Modern-day Persia. What are the laws in modern-day Persia? I want to go over a few of those. Today, we call the country Iran. In modern-day Persia, apostasy is against the law. Apostasy is leaving Islam. For people who leave Islam, it is punishable by death, especially for men who publicly renounce Islam. Women may face life in prison if they renounce Islam. Can't leave the Islamic religion. Another law is blasphemy. You cannot insult the prophet, or any sacred Islamic figure, because, and this, that will result in death. That includes online posts in art or speech. So they call it them that blasphemy if you say anything bad about Muhammad or any of his princes. Another law they have, Islamic law, is what they call corruption on earth. And that is a vague charge that's used against people who dissent or protest, and it will also be a death penalty. You get the idea? There's a lot of death going on here. We're not done yet. Alcohol consumption. If Muslims are caught drinking alcohol, there's 80 lashes per offense. If you offend four times, you're at risk of execution. So they don't have alcohol consumption. They wouldn't do well at Passover. There's a female hijab law, mandatory covering from top to bottom for women. It's mandatory for all women. Some of them you may have seen, the little eye holes are poking. Some of them display face. And there's punishment of prison up to 10 years. They could also be flogged, fined, or under constant surveillance. Another law is if you criticize their supreme leader, we note that they don't call them kings because they hate kings, because that would lead to a restoration of times gone by. Now, following the Iranian Revolution in 1979, I did business with a number of Iranians who left Iran back when it was westernized and they weren't under Islamic rule, and they left with the clothes on their back and a Visa card in their wallet, and that was it. And they escaped and built companies, and I sold a lot of product made in the United States from Iranian refugees. They were Western, like you wouldn't know the difference between them and anybody else on the street. But so I got to know them. They were formed a company in Los Angeles, and they gave me some interesting information about that, about that escape, that they dared say nothing about that, even in exile, because other faithful Persians or Iranians would feel they were doing a duty to God and to come and kill them. So they kept their mouth shut even under exile, because they would have been leaving an Islamic country and saying something. I also had the criticism of supreme leader was an issue. I've had a number of Iranian students over the years, and a number of years ago, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, had an Iranian student. He was like 14, and his family were went back to Iran to visit relatives. And I thought, wow, you can do that? And he went back to Iran, and he came back, and he brought a little statuette of an ancient Persian king. If I could have found it, I'd have brought it today. It's in my archive somewhere in my library. And he brought it back and he said, I smuggled this out for you. Because if he would have been caught, he would have been punished. Because they try to get rid of the current Islamic regime, get rid of the ancient Persian kings, because they don't want the monarchy rising up. What did they do in 1979? They threw off the monarchy when Shah Pahlavi was overthrown and they put in the Islamic Republic. So he smuggled this little statuette out. He said they're trying to do that, but he knew in rural areas they still had them. And so he was able to pick one up. They can't handle the criticism. It's also a law about public affection of unmarried couples. If they're holding hands or kissing in public, 74 lashes of the whip. It's got to hurt. Probably slows down that sort of public affectation. Another law is that women need husband's permission to travel. This means all travel everywhere. They can't leave home without a male relative. They can't get a passport, can't leave the country without the husband or male relative's permission. And then there's a real twitchy one, child marriage. It's legal for girls to get married when they're 13 years or older. They can get married under age 13 if they have their father's approval and court approval. This is modern Islamic law. Another law is compulsory military service. All men are required to serve in the military, and if they don't, they are not allowed any public travel, they can't get a job, and they cannot go to university. A law against cybercrime and online dissent. If they criticize Islam or the regime, they can be sent to prison, have their assets seized, or be under constant surveillance. Another law in modern Iran is they cannot watch Western music, films, or wear their fashion. I got to say they're half right on this, but subject to fines, confiscation, or arrest. And, of course, they're the ones that define what's acceptable and not. An interesting one I found is that women are banned from stadiums. They can't go to men's sports events. And if they do, they will be arrested. Can't think of how many want to go to a lot of sports events. But if their family members are going, they simply can't. Another law says no public singing or dancing by women. It's illegal to sing solo or dance in public, punishable by fines or jail. Gender segregation. Schools, buses, and workplaces are often gender segregated. Males and females are separated by law, and again, the violations would include fines or expulsion from the school or the workplace. And the last one I have in my notes are there's a ban on dog ownership because dogs are unclean, and if you caught walking one in public, it'll cost you jail time or seizure of your pet, and you know they're not going to take good care of your pet after the first 5 minutes. Well, Islam was established in the 7th century AD, about the year 635, and different sects of Islam have developed. The Persian-Iranian version is called Shia, and their followers are Shiite Muslims, but the followers of Islam in Saudi Arabia and other Arab nations are called Sunni Muslims, and these two sects are very unfriendly to each other. They would readily kill each other for not being good enough Muslims. Well, the pillars of Islam are five duties for every Muslim that he has to perform, and one of them is a profession of faith. And then the five daily prayers, that's why they have their prayer towers. They have an alms tax to help the poor, and fasting during the month of Ramadan. Now, bear in mind, their fasting is not doing without food and water for 24 hours. They do without food and water during daylight hours, and when it's dark, then they party all night until then, and then they fast for the next daylight period. So when they fast for a month, don't be surprised that it's not the fast that you're used to. So like my wife and I went to get our annual physical checkup and take our blood test, and they said fast first. So we fast first, and we go there, and they're poking us full of holes and can't get any blood out because we're dehydrated. Come back in 3 days after you've had something to drink. Find out fasting means do without food. Doesn't mean to do without water. But we had to learn that one the hard way and a few poke holes there. So this, and the fifth pillar of Islam is that you must in your lifetime make a pilgrimage to Mecca, which is a holy city in Saudi Arabia, which the Shias in Persia or Iran are not too happy about, but that's an expectation. I want to close with a few questions. And that is, do we have the strength and faith of Mordecai? And what did he do? He had the maturity and responsibility to look after his own household, raising his younger cousin. Mordecai had a respect in his community enough to be a decision maker sitting in the gates. Mordecai had honor and respect with a positive relationship to his family members and giving and taking advice from Hadassah or Esther. It worked both ways, where they had that honor and respect for each other. And Mordecai had the vision or the foresight to see what affects one person can affect an entire nation. Well, the conflict in the Middle East continues, and it will continue to the end of our current age. And despite the crazy influences of the world's decisions, our individual responsibility includes being the best Christian that we can be. So what are those responsibilities? Well, I'm going to list those. If you have the five pillars of Islam, surely we have some important characteristics of being a Christian. To follow the commandments of God. To be good decision makers. To look forward to the return of Jesus Christ to the earth. Look forward to the establishment of the kingdom of God. And look forward to the joining of the family of God. The sum of this is, let us all be a good Mordecai or a good Esther.